I'm sick, I mumble. I just got sick. Yeah, no shit. Come on, we'll clean you up. I fumble to get a cigarette lit, and Jackie takes one from my pack. I gotta go home. Well then, let me drive you. You sure? Yeah, of course. What are you doing out here? I ask. Did you see Eliza? She speaks softly, like you would to a child, which I guess is kind of what I am. Yeah, I ran into her coming in. She told me you were sick. Great. Anyway, I needed an excuse to get out of there. You mean the party? Yeah, the party. And I don't know. Preston, too. We cross over in front of the golf course and walk down onto the carefully manicured lawn toward her little Volkswagen. While I may have barfed on the girl of my dreams and totally humiliated myself, I think at least I have Jackie, and she has me. I walk quickly around to the passenger side of her car. There is vomit still wet on my shirt front, and I still want to fucking cry. 16. My mom is awake when I get home, sitting in the dark, drinking white wine and watching Double Indemnity on TV for like the billionth time. She seems a little drunk, honestly, as I stumble in, and I guess that's probably why she doesn't freak out at the sight of me as much as she normally would, because me coming home covered in puke like this would be just the type of thing to send her into a panic. Seriously, my mom is absolutely the worst person to be with in any kind of crisis situation. She completely loses her shit, going from zero to full-blown hysteria in like half a second. But tonight, surprisingly, she remains relatively calm. She pauses the movie and stands up, coming around to put her cool hand on my hot forehead. I think you have a fever. Are you okay? What happened? The smell of her is so familiar and comforting that I choke up. I got sick, I say, and then I burst into tears. Oh, sweetie. Come here, love, she says, putting her arms around me. But I'm all gross. She tells me not to worry, and so I cry into her sweatshirt and the warmth of her as she holds me, and I feel so tired, so completely exhausted. What happened? She asks. Were you drinking? I sniffle. No, it's my medicine. I forgot to eat before going to the party, and I took all my meds at once, and I got sick. Hey, she says, kissing the top of my head and shushing me gently. It happens to everyone, all right? Don't be so hard on yourself. Oh, yeah, I think. Tons of people decide to take their psych meds all at once and then blow their only chance to be with the girl they've loved basically forever by puking on her. Happens all the time. I feel like digging a hole in the backyard and then curling up in there and just wasting away until there is nothing left. Here, she whispers. You go get cleaned up, and I'll make you something to eat, all right? No, don't worry about it. You need to eat, she says. It's no problem. And then, try to be quiet going in your room. Jane wanted to sleep in there because she was having a bad dream. Is that okay? I nod. It makes sense. She'd been sharing a room with Teddy since she was 3 years old. No wonder she can't sleep in there. I go into my room and manage to get out some pajamas from the drawer without waking Janie up. The sound of her breathing is soft and calming in the darkness. By the time I take a quick shower and brush my teeth and put on my pajamas, my mom's already finished making me a grilled cheese sandwich and some hot chocolate. I thank her, and then we sit down together on the couch. My mom turns the movie back on, and I eat silently and lean against her. I watch Fred McMurray climbing the steps to Barbara Stanwyck's Spanish-style house somewhere in 1940s Los Angeles. When he rings the doorbell, I know that she will answer, and I know that by the end of the film, she will have killed him. I settle in to watch the movie, trying not to think of anything else. Fred McMurray is being suckered into committing a murder for this woman he barely even knows, but has fallen hopelessly in love with. For him, the money is secondary. All he cares about is her, and all she cares about is herself. It's an old story. Adam conned by Eve into eating the apple. The images flash black and white across the screen. My mom whispers, "I love you, sweetie." I close my eyes and open them. "I love you too, Mom." We watch the movie together. And for now at least, that is enough. 17. The sound of Janie screaming wakes me up early, before it's all the way light outside. She's sleeping in my bed, and I'm on a blow-up mattress, so I get up onto my knees and put a hand on her sweating forehead. She jerks and twitches in her sleep, yelling, "Stop! Stop!" "Jane," I say, "it's just a dream." Her eyes open slowly. "Miles," she says, wrapping her small arms around my neck and crying out, "It was awful." She hugs me, and I inhale the smell of her, which is like peppermint and fresh-cut grass. "You had a bad dream?" Her head nods up and down as she pokes her bottom lip out and sniffles. "Sharks." A shiver runs through me, thinking about the ocean that day, about Teddy. "I'm afraid of sharks too," I say. She smiles. Posters of different jazz musicians are hung up against the patterned wallpaper that looks like some kind of tree with branches like lungs and leaves like 100 eyes wide open. There's a mirror on one wall that reflects the wallpaper pattern on the other, so it looks like a framed painting. I also have a collection of taxidermy insects behind glass cases, beetles mostly, and butterflies, and a bat framed with its wings spread out, hanging next to the open closet with no door. There's a replica of a human skull on my dresser, next to a set of blown glass medicine bottles from the 20s or 30s. "Hey," I say, standing all the way up and stretching. "You want to go out for coffee and donuts? Or a hot chocolate and donuts? I have a little bit of money left from my last paycheck." She smiles and nods excitedly. Her eyes get brighter. "All right, well," I continue. "Go get dressed warm and we'll go. But be quiet, okay? So you don't wake up Mom and Dad." She pushes the covers back. "No way. I won't wake him up." She hops out of bed, wearing a flannel nightgown our grandmother sewed for her, and tiptoes over to the next room, while I throw on clothes and an Army-Navy surplus dark blue peacoat. I peer out the blinds and see the tall grass and overgrown weeds are wet and heavy with dew. The sun is yet to rise over the curve of the world to the east, but its rays fill the morning sky with white light turning gray around the edges as it fights to overtake the darkness of night. It will be a clear day. I can see that already. There are no clouds, no fog. The sun filling the white-gray sky with the beginnings of color. I feel an odd sense of hope. But then I see the crows, gathering on the telephone wires, waiting, watching me through the window. Their black eyes dart in every direction. They scratch and claw. They call out. They cover the wires, just as the wires cover the skyline. Janie tugs on the sleeve of my coat, startling me a little.
"Wow, look at all those crows."
I close the blinds, take a step back from the window. "What? What did you say?" She smiles sweetly.
"The crows. Those are crows, right? Or are they ravens?"
I crouch down closer to her. "You can see them too?" She laughs.
"Of course, silly."
I stand up straight, feeling relieved. I take her hand and lead her out into the still, early morning. We cross the street and the sun is bright, and I think that here with my sister, everything is okay. 18. Work drags on for fucking ever. The manager has me working in the back room, unloading canned goods, checking their different prices and sticking stickers on them with a pricing gun, and marking off the quantities on the invoice sheet. It's dark, and I squint my eyes and wish I were home and keep checking my phone to see what time it is, even though that just makes my shift seem to go all the more slowly. Not to mention that a boring-ass task like this gives me that much more time to replay last night's events over in my mind. An endless loop of me saying stupid shit to Eliza, and then barfing on her again and again, over and over. So I go on unpacking the boxes and pointlessly trying to block the memory out until I finally check my phone again and I see that I have a text message I somehow missed. From fucking Ordell. He writes in all capital letters, "Dude, did you puke on Eliza Lindberg? LOL. Call me." I read it again. I wonder if maybe my mind is playing a trick on me. If this is just some kind of paranoid delusion like the goddamn crows. But then, as if on cue, the phone chimes right there in my hand. Another text. "I'm serious, dude. Call me. Everyone's talking about it." Again with the 3 exclamation marks. My heart pounds loudly in my ears so that everything else is blotted out around me. A cold sweat breaks out at the back of my neck. I strip off my apron and the sweater I'm wearing and my thermal undershirt. But still I'm flushed and sweating. And so I leave the boxes there and I go out the back door, not even caring if my manager comes and yells at me. The day is clear, and the wind is strong and the light feels distant and cold and pale. The smell of the garbage from the large metal dumpster in the alley is sickening, so I walk around to the residential street behind the market, sitting on the curb and breathing heavily, rocking my body back and forth. I rock there and feel the cold and try to figure out what the hell I'm going to do. Could Eliza really have told everyone what happened? I mean, it's not that I care what other people think particularly. It's just disappointing that she wouldn't want to, I don't know, protect me? I light a cigarette then, and the smoke fills my lungs and my fingers twitch and shake. The crows are in the branches of the bare, skinny trees, planted in square patches of dirt in the sidewalk. The wires crisscross and crackle across the white stucco apartment complexes. My eyes close and open. I try to make the images disappear, but it's never any fucking good. My mind unravels like a ball of string rolling down an unending staircase. There's a dead squirrel lying torn apart in the middle of the street, and the crows pick through the still bloody carcass, fighting loudly over the very best pieces. I turn away and smoke, and try to focus on the cold and the wind and the gritty asphalt beneath my boots. The curb where I'm sitting has been painted a dark green, but the color is faded and completely washed away in places. A car drives past out front, and I turn to see the crows quickly scatter, only to reconvene over the mess of dead squirrel a few seconds later. I stand up then and stamp my foot. "Get out of here!" I yell, feeling this surge of heat and anger from out of nowhere. "Go on! Get out!" Before I can even think about what I'm doing, I run out and yell louder, and the crows squawk at me and fly off. I stand over the squirrel's lifeless body and clench my fists as though just daring the crows to take another shot at it. But they don't. My phone vibrates in my pocket, and I look to see that Preston's calling. I decide I can't fucking deal with it, though, so I don't answer. A few seconds later, the phone chimes again. A text message from Preston. "Hey man, you all right? I gave your number to Eliza. I hope you don't mind. Are you sick?" I laugh at that. 3 question marks. I don't write him back. I finish my cigarette and go back inside. The boxes are waiting. None of this matters compared to Teddy, of course. I know that. I do. But it hurts fucking bad. And so I try to figure out what the hell I'm gonna do. 19. By the time I get home, the sun is nearly set on the horizon, so the brightest stars are already shining through the settling dark and the faint orange glow of city lights. Because Janie and I can't start watching the movies I rented, Harold and Maude and Being There, my favorite Hal Ashby films, until after dinner. We are busy working together on a drawing on a card table set up next to the fireplace. The drawing we're doing is part of a larger project. I mean, it's kind of silly, really, but we're trying to put a comic book together. It's the story of these 2 characters she created. They're 1920s flapper girls named Mabel and Pearl. Honestly, Janie draws way better than I do, but I try to keep up. My mom has taken a pill and gone to bed, apparently, and so I put on that Washington Phillips record that I bought the other day at Amoeba. I'm not sure what my mom was talking about. The music's not depressing at all. If anything, this guy must have been like a preacher or something, because every song is about God and Jesus and how great everything is going to be in heaven. I'd love to be able to believe in something like that. Plus, the man's voice is so sweet and pure and beautiful. It's a good album. Hey, if you like this, you should check out these other records, too. My dad walks over and crouches down next to the dark wood cabinet where he keeps his vinyl collection. Here, he says, piling a couple albums up on the table next to our drawing. My dad is wearing a collared dress shirt, rolled up to the elbows and open at the neck. Vinyl pajama bottoms and plush furry slippers. The pajamas are loose and hanging off him a little. Blind Willie Johnson, he says, standing up straighter to show me one of the records. He really was blind. Janie's gap-toothed smile is just the greatest, and my dad musses her hair with his large, calloused hands. And check this out, he says, passing her one final record. Robert Johnson. People say he made a deal with the devil. That's how he learned to play the blues.
Wow, Jane says. Can we listen to this now?
Sure.
Here, I got it, I tell my dad.
I take the record from him and carry it over to where the turntable is set up. You guys hungry? He asks.
Yeah, says Janie.
Yeah, me too, I guess, I say. He goes to open the refrigerator and kind of grumbles. Slim pickings in here. How about some fried egg sandwiches? And bacon. I put the record on, and it crackles and pops loudly as the guitar music starts to play. The singing is pained and full of gravel and broken glass and dust and mud. It is beautiful. Jane keeps on drawing while I go over to the kitchen to help my dad fry up the bacon. He makes some black coffee on the electric burner and some hot chocolate for Janie. Then he cooks up a bunch of thick pieces of wheat bread in the grease from the bacon and fries the eggs right there in the same pan. Really, there's not that much I can do to help but just make the plates up. Hey, my dad says to me, if you want, maybe you and me can play some music together later. Pull out the old guitars. I smile. That'd be great. He lays the bacon and egg sandwiches out on the plates, and I pour the coffee and cocoa, and then go over to turn on the TV. Janie sits next to me on the couch, and my dad sits on the floor. He always likes to watch 60 Minutes on Sunday nights, so we all watch it together. There's that part at the beginning where the anchors take turns saying, I'm Steve Croft, and I'm Leslie Stahl, and Teddy would always jump in saying, and I'm Teddy Cole. He thought that was just the funniest thing ever. But now it's like we all have to talk over the opening, so there isn't time to think about it.
Thanks, Dad, Jane says. This sandwich is really good.
Miles helped too, he answers, and she says,
thank you, Miles.
Then I tell her she's welcome. We all watch the show and eat together, and the fire is going, and the wind rattles the screen door outside. Everything is so nice like this, right now with my family, and I wish I could just stay in this moment forever, and never have to deal with Eliza or medication or doctors, or go back to school, and never have to do anything ever again except to be here with my dad and sister. And Teddy, of course. Teddy would be here. He would be watching the show with us like he used to. And then my mom would be here too, just like she used to. Someday it will be like that again. Someday soon. So I kiss Jane's forehead quickly, and take her and my dad's plates and go wash them in the hot water in the sink. My phone is there on the counter, and I see the little blue missed call light is blinking. I dry my hands on a checkered dishcloth and pick up my phone, even though I know I probably shouldn't, that I should just forget everything until tomorrow. But I can't. I can't do that. The number is one I don't recognize, but it's got a 415 area code, which is San Francisco. I scroll through the menu options and then dial my voicemail, waiting, my stomach tight, my lungs contracted. Her voice sounds sweet and beautiful and sexy, even through the slight electronic distortion of my phone. It's Eliza, of course. She says that right off.
Miles? Hey, it's Eliza. Call me back, okay? I'm so sorry people are talking about this,
Please know I didn't mean to tell anyone. I was just worried about you last night, but I should have just kept my mouth shut. Can you forgive me? And, please, I want to hang out with you again. And I don't want you to be, you know, embarrassed at all right? You didn't do anything wrong. Do you want to, like, get coffee after school tomorrow, maybe? Okay, thanks, Miles. It was so good to see you again. And, I don't know. Shoot. Just to call me, okay? Bye. I erase the message quickly. My hands tremble. You all right, Mai? My dad calls from the living room. Yeah, I'm fine. I'll be right there.
What are you doing?
Janie asks. Nothing. I gotta take my medicine. It's okay, just keep watching. I'll be back. I leave my phone on the counter and walk into the bathroom and turn the lights on. The bulb overhead is out, but the one above the small mirror flickers on after a moment. There are some tiles with painted pink roses and white daisies all lined up at about eye level. The sink is stained and the faucet is white with calcium deposits. I open the top drawer and take out the different prescription bottles. Fluoxetine, 60 milligrams per day, which is just generic Prozac, an antidepressant. And then there's the Lamictal, 200 milligrams a day, which is a mood stabilizer. Then there's the lithium, 800 milligrams a day, and the Depakote, 300 milligrams a day, which builds something called gray matter, whatever that is, and are supposed to help with the racing, paranoid, delusional thinking. And then there's the Abilify, 10 milligrams a day, which is specifically for schizophrenia, and the Zyprexa, 10 milligrams a day, the newest of the drugs. It's supposed to make you put on a ton of weight once you start taking it, but it hasn't for me at all. I'm just skin and bones. The mirror reflects my sunken image, my eyes swollen and bloodshot. The color around my pupils is a golden yellowish brown. I stare straight into my own eyes. I turn on the tap so the cold water can run a minute. There's an empty plastic cup next to the toothbrushes, and I fill it with water. The light flickers overhead. When I close my eyes, there's an image projected on the back of my eyelids of Eliza the way she looked yesterday. I see her smiling. I see her leaning forward to kiss me. I see her, and I reach out and take her hand in mine. There's a smell of her there with me suddenly. I inhale deeply and take the smell of her into my mouth and down the back of my throat and then into my lungs and into my belly. I remember that smell so clearly from when we were kids together. When her mom and dad were driving us back from the beach one time, I remember Eliza falling asleep with her head on my shoulder and her hair getting all tangled in my mouth, and I wanted her to stay sleeping like that forever on me. But last night should have been even better. Last night she actually kissed me. It really did happen. I open my eyes. I can still feel her with me. And I want to keep feeling her with me. I want that more than anything. Maybe someday, after I find Teddy and he's safely home, then I can start worrying about girls and all that normal high school stuff. For now, I have to put that aside. I look down at the bottles lined up there on the tiled counter. Just the thought of those pills sticking in my throat, the taste of them going down, slowly dissolving in my mouth as I try to gulp the water down, it's enough to make me want to throw up right now. I pour the four capsules of the powdered lithium out into my hand. They are an off-colored, sickly pink, glossy, with tiny numbers printed along the center seam. I put the pills in my mouth and start to swallow, but they seem caught somehow. Then I cough and gag as they stick there. I try again to swallow, but I can't. I can't do it. I choke and spit the pills out into the sink. God damn it, I say, gasping, fighting for air. I grab the already dissolving pills out of the sink and drop them into the trash. Then I open each of the individual pill bottles and empty their entire contents into the toilet. I flush, twice actually, because they don't all go down the first time. I splash some water on my face and then turn off the spigot. I can't, I tell my reflection, shaking my head. I can't do it anymore. I dry my face and hands on a ratty towel hung over the shower. I switch the light off and close the door. The medication is gone. And now I am ready to make things right here, at home, with my family. Tomorrow I will go to the police station. I'll talk to Detective Marshall. And it will be all right. 20. The central branch of the San Francisco Police Department is located right on the border between North Beach and Chinatown, in an unassuming two-story building behind a nameless liquor store, and directly across from two different strip clubs, Big Al's and the Garden of Eden. North Beach is maybe my favorite part of the city. It's a little touristy, I guess, but that's just because it's so beautiful. I've never been to Europe, but from the movies I've seen, I think it must look something like the streets here in North Beach. The roads are very narrow, built on the steep, complicated, crisscrossing hills leading up to Coit Tower. The Victorian-style buildings, cafes, and trotterias pressed right up against one another. There are a few grand old churches, built out of white marble and surrounded by stone courtyards. Before Jane and Teddy were born, my mom and dad lived with me not too far from here. My dad used to take me on walks down around Washington Square Park, and then he'd write at Cafe Trieste while I drew in a notebook and drank hot chocolate and ate these raspberry ring pastry things. Actually, now that I think about it, once I was older, my dad used to take me and Eliza to that same Cafe Trieste every Sunday to listen to opera music while he worked on his stories for the paper. Walking through North Beach after school, where I basically spent the whole day hiding, can't help but think back on those times with Eliza. It's only a little after 3, but already the sun is low on the horizon, setting behind the high-rise buildings along the marina to the west. Everything is gray with shadow, and the wind tunnels down the alleyways, blowing the streets clean as pigeons scurry like rats across the sidewalk. I light a cigarette, but then throw it away immediately once I see all the cops hanging out around the front of the station, since I'm still under 18 and could probably get a ticket or something. The cops outside are talking to one another in loud voices, drinking coffee out of styrofoam cups, their uniforms crisp and polished looking. Police cars are parked and double parked all up and down the street. Inside the station is all cheap tile floors, colorless threadbare carpeting, and dark paneled walls. There are posters taped up advertising different police services, along with a bunch of missing person flyers and mugshots. Against the far end of the main room there's a reception desk, where a rather large woman is sitting behind an ancient-looking computer, wearing a bright blue police uniform. There are a couple of wooden benches set up in front of the reception area, but surprisingly, no one seems to be waiting. A big cop with a really big mustache pushes past me, so I almost fall back. "Hey, watch it," he says gruffly. "Don't stand in the door." I take a deep breath and hold it, walking over to the receptionist lady with my eyes fixed on the ground. My heart beats fast and hard. "Can I help you?" the woman asks, but without looking at me. The computer screen lights up her broad face, and I can see what must be some kind of spreadsheet reflected in the framed, oversized printout of the department's anti-discrimination policy behind her. She has short, silver-gray hair and thick, tufted eyebrows, and quite a bit of fur on her upper lip. Her mouth is turned down at the corners, and there are deep-set lines around her eyes and crossing her waxen, pale forehead. "Yes, what is it?" she tries again. "What do you want?" I... My voice trembles, though there's really no reason why it should. I guess I'm just nervous, is all. I'm nervous to talk about Teddy. "Spit it out, kid, I don't have all day." She speaks in a monotone, still typing at the computer and not looking at me. I'm here to see Detective Marshall. Detective Kerry Marshall. The woman's head swings back and forth slowly, her eyes fixed on the screen. "Nope, Detective Marshall was transferred to Santa Clara last year." My breath catches in my throat, and instinctively, I take a step back. What do you mean? "He was transferred," she says, without any inflection whatsoever. "Detective William Demarest has taken over all of Detective Marshall's cases. Would you like to talk to Detective Demarest?" "Well, I don't know. Do you, remember the case of the little boy who went missing from Ocean Beach?" She keeps typing, still not looking over at me. Lots of children go missing, I'm afraid. Yes, but this was Detective Marshall's case. A boy, Teddy Cole, was kidnapped from Ocean Beach 2 years ago. It was in all the papers. Teddy Bryant Cole. Finally, the woman stops. She moves her hands off the keyboard and turns to look at me full on. Her eyes study me. For the first time, there is a hint of color behind the dull gray of her irises. Teddy Bryant. That case was never solved. No, I say timidly. That's why I wanted to talk to Detective Marshall. Teddy Bryant Cole is my brother. The woman shakes her head, her lips held tightly together.
I am so sorry, she says. I am so very sorry for your loss.
My nostrils flare and I grip my teeth.
Teddy is not dead,
I want to tell her, but she interrupts me, saying, I'm sure Detective Demarest will be happy to speak with you. Just wait over there for a moment. She gestures with her head to the empty benches. I nod. Yes, okay. Thank you. It'll just be a moment. And then she smiles again, this time showing off a row of stained yellow teeth. I sit, waiting on the bench, my legs crossed. There's a loud noise as the front doors seem to slam open, and two police officers, one male and one female, carry a screaming man, hogtied, through the main entranceway.
Fucking cocksuckers, he screams.
Two more men are dragged in the same way behind the first, so all three of them can be heard screaming together.
Fuckers! Motherfuckers!
The receptionist woman comes back then, walking just in front of an extremely short man with close-cropped hair and a dark-colored suit and necktie. The man introduces himself as Detective William Demarest, but tells me to call him Bill. I shake his hand and thank the woman, who smiles at me before heading back to her desk. Detective Demarest, Bill, says that I should follow him, and so I do, walking behind him through a side door and away from those three different hog-tied men screaming profanities. I'm sorry, I stutter out, as we make our way down the cramped hallway, past identical windowless offices with different nameplates tacked up on each door. You must be really busy. There are trophy cases piled high with different awards, and a collection of different badges framed on the yellowed walls.
Oh yes, busy, 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 he says in a booming bass voice. It sure does get crazy in here sometimes. This city's just full of them. Crazies, I mean. I've been here going on 25 years, but I still can't get used to it. Suppose you never do. I thought going from homicide to missing persons was going to be easier somehow. Don't know what the hell I was thinking.
He turns into the office with his name on the door, and I go in after him.
Take a seat there, he tells me, pointing to the only chair in the room.
Are you sure? I ask, considering, as I said, there's literally no other chair in the office.
Yeah, sit. I'm all right. Here.
He pushes some papers onto the floor and moves the lamp, and then sits on the corner of the desk so he looks like a little kid, maybe, or like Kermit the Frog, his legs dangling. Besides the desk and the papers and the lamp and the one chair, the rest of the office is nothing but filing boxes all stacked one on top of another. The walls are completely blank, and there's not even an inch of free floor space.
Sit down, he tells me again.
And so I do, holding my backpack on my lap as I lean against the hard metal chair.
Are you just moving into this office?
I ask dumbly, not sure of what else to say. He laughs good-heartedly, running his stubby hand through his lack of hair. His nose is very wide, and he has a scar on his chin running straight across, like he's been divided into segments.
You'd think it to look at this place, wouldn't you? He says, smiling. But no, I've been here a whole year. Took over for Detective Marshall. Did you know him then?
No. But he was working on my brother's case. Demarest nods, still smiling.
Yes, yes. Louise told me. Let's see, I've got the file here.
I'm sorry, son.
I know your family's been going through a hard time.
He begins rummaging through the boxes of files scattered everywhere.
Believe it or not, he continues, still riffling, there's a whole system I got worked out here.
I got every case filed just so. Only sometimes I outsmart myself. You know what I mean? I think myself into a corner. You ever do that, son? Standing up straight, he turns and looks at me as though trying to read in my face the answer to his question. No, I don't figure you do. You're smart one, I bet. Always got everything put back in its proper place. Isn't that so? He goes back to looking while I try to say something. Oh, that's all right, he tells me. I've got all the respect in the world for good organizational skills. Now take that Detective Marshall who was here before me. Why, he kept the most detailed notes I ever read in my damn... He clears his throat. Darn life, that's what I mean. And I respect a man like that. I came in here and started reading his case files, and sure enough, it was like reading literature. William Shakespeare. He had a real talent. And organized. Me, I've got my own system. But sometimes... So you read about my brother's case? I ask, interrupting him this time. Sure, of course I did. Tragic stuff. Emerging triumphant, he lays the surprisingly thin file folder on the table and takes a seat on top of it. I've been doing a lot of reading, too, I tell him. I think my brother might still be alive. That's what I wanted to see you about. That witness, Dottie Peterson, I saw her the other day. She seemed pretty sure that Teddy really was kidnapped. He frowns at me, his jowls shaking like the gristle on a burned piece of meat. Yes. Well, the sad truth is, that woman, the witness, she's really not, reliable. Of course, I can't discuss too many details of the case, but her story, it didn't hold up. Not at all. What do you mean? He pulls the file out from underneath him and begins flipping through it absently. Well, from what I understand, Detective Marshall had a sketch drawn up of the suspect based on Miss Peterson's description. Here it is, in fact, right here. The photocopy of the drawing is in black and white, and I hold it, trembling now, staring down at that face, the face of the man who took my brother. What we normally do in a case like this is to both circulate and cross-reference the sketch with our database. These kinds of abductions are almost always perpetrated by sex offenders. So we pulled up every registered sex offender within a 30-mile radius from the spot the victim, your brother, was taken. Anyone fitting the physical description was immediately brought in for questioning, especially if the subject had any contact with the victim. Most times we find the suspects have seen their victims at least once before. Often they've even had some sort of interaction with them. So we cross-check all those different pieces of information. And from what I can see here, looks like they came back with a list of 4 possible suspects. Oh, and there was the car. He says the last part as though surprising himself, pausing to read for a moment before continuing on. That's right. That same witness identified a car, a white Ford Explorer. So we ran a check to see if there were any registered Explorer owners on the sex offender list. It looks like there was one relevant match, but... Grimacing, he turns the papers over one after another. From what I can see here, kid, I'm sorry to say, none of the leads panned out in any way. And then again, just between you and me, I mean off the record, that witness didn't stand up real well under questioning. He closes the file, then reaches in his jacket pocket and pulls out a pack of Trident gum. Spearmint, I think. Gum? He asks, holding it up to me. No, thank you. He takes a piece for himself and starts unwrapping it. Quit smoking a month ago, he says bitterly. He chomps on his gum and finally says, I'm sorry. I really should be getting back to work. Is there anything else I can tell you, son? No, I answer, bowing my head. I just wondered if there was anything new, I guess. Do you think I could look at that file? I'm sorry, pal, can't do it. But the truth is, there's not a lot here. The general opinion is that the witness was mistaken. Chances are, Teddy Bryant drowned that day. 99.99%. I'm very sorry. I wish I had better news for you. If you want, I can... But just then, another detective sticks his head into the office. a large man with a bald, shiny head, reflecting the buzzing and crackling fluorescent lights overhead.
Hey, Bill. Sorry, can I get your signature in here for a second?
Demarest nods.
Sure thing.
And then to me.
Wait here a second. I'll come walk you out.
He leaves, jumping down off the desk with a thud. And so I'm left staring at the file.
Drowned, this guy says.
But what does he know, really? He's not even the original detective. Plus, this whole place seems a little crazy. So what I do is, I leap forward and grab the file and tear through it, my heart beating so fast I can hardly breathe. Sweat breaks out all across my forehead. My vision blurs. But still, I'm able to find the page with the suspects' names. There are even photos, and what look like street addresses. I take the pages and quickly stuff them into my backpack, closing the file and jumping to my feet, knocking the chair over. My breathing slows. I wipe the sweat from my face with the sleeve of my jacket and set the chair to right. Detective Demarest does not come back, but I leave the office anyway, closing the door behind me. There is no one in the hall, so I walk quickly out to the main room. That woman at the front smiles at me and waves. I go out the door. No one tries to stop me. I have the information I need now. And I will find Teddy. Because, despite what anyone might say, I know that he is alive. I know it because I feel it. Like a clear, cool breeze blowing through my mind. Part 2. 21. Outside, the fog has settled in over the city, so the streets and skies and buildings and cars and people walking with their heads down and the crows and pigeons and everything are gray and muted silver. After stealing that list of suspects and being so close to finding Teddy, you'd think the clouds would have parted and the sun would be shining down like a goddamn golden halo all around me. That's how it would work if this were a movie. But there is only gray and fog and trash, and a thick layer of black sludge ground and beaten into the sidewalk. A bus goes lumbering past, rumbling and shaking, the men and women crowded together inside, sitting and standing. I run across the street and then go fast up a couple of blocks to get away from the police station, just in case Detective Demarest notices part of my brother's file is missing. Not that he will. He'll stuff the folder back in with all those others as part of his system. Then he'll forget about it. He'll forget about Teddy, like everyone else has. I'm the only one left who can help him. And so I need to get home as soon as possible to look over what I have. I hike up the hill to the bus stop on Grant, next to Cafe Trieste. I turn to see someone waving at me from inside the coffee shop.
Miles!
Of course it's Eliza. She comes out the swinging door, not set right on its hinges. I say, of course, only because fate or karma, or whatever fucking else, clearly has it in for me. So it has to be Eliza. Looking beautiful as always, dark hair pulled back, her face pale, her eyes flashing green-blue against the gray. She's wearing tight jeans and fur-lined boots and a hooded parka. It's cold outside, and she rubs her small hands together.
Hey,
I say to her, still moving, wanting to get away. But she immediately starts talking. Then she asks me to sit down.
What are you doing here? I ask.
She smiles.
Homework. I'm so far behind.
Those pages I stole are stashed in my backpack, and I want so badly just to go home and read through them. But now Eliza is saying to me,
Come on, Mai. Come sit down for a minute.
I follow her in and order coffee, and then I ask her if we can go back outside so I can smoke. She grabs her books and backpack, and we go sit at one of the unsteady tables. Across the street, there is a white church with steeples like pulled sugar stretching up above the white marble steps. There is a pack of street kids huddled together beneath the vaulted arches, wearing army gear and wrapped in tattered wool blankets. They have some sort of off-white pit bull mix tied to a long piece of rope.
Aw, what a cute dog,
Eliza says, exhaling the smoke a little theatrically from the cigarette I gave her.
Did you know my mom and I brought a puppy back from New Orleans?
Awesome. What kind?
A bloodhound, she says, looking down at her hands. Seriously, they are absolutely the cutest things in the entire world. Her legs are crossed, and she leans forward. She's very close to me now. I can feel the heat from her body. I don't want to feel it, but I do. So I keep on dipping my raspberry ring thing into my big bowl of coffee with sugar and milk. Miles, she says, bowing her head. Listen, I'm really sorry. I didn't mean for it to get out, about what happened. When I came back in, I was just upset. And Mackenzie Miller was right there when I told Lily. Remember her? She transferred to Lincoln in 8th grade, and she was totally my best friend. Yeah, of course, I tell her, which is the truth. Well, believe me, she wouldn't have said anything, I promise. And I really was too freaked out to notice all the people standing around us. But I think it was Mackenzie. That's what Ian Larkin told me. He said he heard it from her. I breathe then and drink my coffee. I don't want to care about any of this. Look, it's okay. I knew you didn't mean for it to get out.
Really? Oh, good, Miles. I was worried.
No, I'm fine. And listen, I hope you know that it had nothing to do with you. I'm on a lot of medication, and I get super sick if I don't eat enough. But anyway, I'm sorry I puked on you. I smile then, and so does she. Well, technically, she starts, stubbing out her cigarette in the red plastic ashtray laid out between us. You didn't puke on me, but you were close. She giggles sweetly so the table shakes a little, and some of her coffee spills into the saucer. A hipster guy in his early 20s walks past, transfixed by the screen of his iPhone, though he still manages to stop and do a kind of double take when he notices Eliza. He stares and then catches himself staring, and diverts his eyes back to his phone and keeps on walking. It's not a big deal or anything. I mean, it's just a moment, and yet it is enough to remind me that Eliza is really, truly out of my league. I swallow and blush and say, That guy was totally checking you out just then. Did you see that? Her head tilts to the side.
What? Who?
That hipster dude that walked by. You didn't notice?
Uh-uh.
She smiles with her lips pressed together. I bet that happens to you all the time, I say. Maybe because I'm already feeling jealous, which is so totally dumb.
Yeah, I guess. I'm sort of used to it, you know?
Not to sound all full of myself or anything. I shake my head. No, of course not. It's just a fact, right? You're super beautiful. But right after I say that, my face goes hot and I'm embarrassed as hell, and my heart races and I smoke and don't look at her. It came out sounding really awkward, too.
No, I'm not.
I can hear her fidgeting around.
But thank you.
My throat is very dry. Sorry, was that weird I said that? Her body moves closer to mine.
No, are you kidding? You're so sweet. Coming back here, I was scared you were going to hate me for what I did, and maybe even blame me for what happened.
I cross my legs and make myself small in my chair.
Blame you?
Yeah, for what happened to you.
Not at all, I say hurriedly.
Me having that episode... I mean, it's a disease. Bad wiring in my brain. It's nobody's fault. Nobody's. She takes another deep breath and exhales noisily.
I know that. But, I don't know, it's just so weird that it happened, like, right after that thing with you and me. Right after I left.
I mean, wasn't it after that?
Well, yeah, it was.
But it's just a coincidence. She rubs my arm a little. I wanted to call you after I found out. I really did. Except, well, like I said, I thought you might be mad at me.
No, I was never mad at you. Not ever.
I'm so happy to hear that, she says, talking softer now. I hope we can start hanging out again now that I'm back. I sit up straight, and I'm not sure what to say, but I turn toward her and she's leaning across the table. So I lean in too. and then we kiss for real this time. Our mouths fit perfectly together, and I taste the warmth and sweetness of her, and my body feels lifted off the ground. We kiss like that until one of those kids from across the street whistles like, woo-hoo, at us. "You want to go?" she whispers at me. And I feel drunk or high or both. We walk down the street together back toward the bus stop, and this time we are holding hands and leaning against each other. And it's so strange because walking to the cafe, we were just friends from long ago running into each other. And now we're like a couple. At least, I think we're a couple. I kiss her then, as if to ask her. And she kisses me back, and she looks up at me. And the fog is wet and thick around us. And her eyes shine out, and she smiles, and I know the answer must be yes. Only that can't be the answer for me. Not yet. Not until I bring Teddy back home. I stop and breathe, and press the palm of my hand against my forehead. "What's wrong?" she asks. "Nothing," I say. I want this. I do. But I can't. Not right now. She tilts her head to one side. But I thought you were better. I am better. But it's not that. I can't talk about it too much. Not yet.
What do you mean?
I start to answer and then stop. As much as I want to talk to her about Teddy, I know that I can't. She would try to stop me. She might even tell my parents. And that's the last fucking thing I need. None of them will understand. They'll think I'm being reckless. And anyway, I'm trying to keep them from dealing with the pain of all this. That's the fucking point. I can't tell her. So what I say is something completely fucking stupid. I just, need to focus on my own stuff. I'm sorry. She looks up then, right into my eyes, taking hold of my hands in hers.
Okay. Yeah, no, I get it.
You do?
Yeah. For sure.
The bus lumbers up to the stop, and the brakes exhale loudly, and the door opens. It's her bus, the 15, not mine. Eliza gets on board.
See you tomorrow, she tells me.
The doors close, and the bus drives off. 22. There's no lock on my bedroom door, but that's just the way the house was built. It has nothing to do with me. I shut myself in and throw my backpack on the unmade bed. The light on the side table has been left on, but it's fully dark outside, so I turn on the overhead light too, sit down on the bed and take out the pages. My hands shake as I try to focus my eyes on the words and images. The photos are black and white copies, grainy. My eyes keep watering and I shiver, still not able to see clearly. God damn it, I say. I turn the pages over, upside down on the bed, and go up to the computer on my desk, putting on some music to try to calm down a little bit. The library is set to shuffle, and just by chance a John Lennon song plays, and it is calming, and I go back to the bed. It's a love song, John singing, "Even if it's just a day, I miss you when you're away. I wish you were here today, dear Yoko." Turning the pages back over, it looks as if the detectives have highlighted the names and addresses of the most likely suspects. The one sex offender on the list who fits Dottie Peterson's description and drives a white Ford Explorer lives only 3 blocks from Ocean Beach, so that seems like a pretty damn good lead. And as I'm reading about the man's alibi, the alibi that cleared him, I notice, unbelievably, that the cops got the date of the actual kidnapping wrong. No wonder Teddy's never been found. These police are seriously incompetent. The date they've written is exactly 1 week later than the day in question. So the alibi of the man, Simon Tolliver, is totally meaningless. That breeze comes clear and cool in my mind. Half the junior class is taking a trip down to Ocean Beach tomorrow to clean up trash. Hopefully I can slip away for a minute to check out Tolliver's house. For all I know, Teddy is there right now. Reading more about Tolliver, though, I have to admit, I'm a little scared to go confront him. The guy sounds like a total psycho.
and while the report states that he's been compliant with his parole officer for almost a decade, he'd been in prison for 15 years before that. So he's obviously a bad fucking dude. And honestly, even though I know I should go and scope out his house, I'm kind of scared about having anything to do with a crazy-ass psycho like that. But I will. I'll go there tomorrow, and I won't get caught. There's a Joy Division song now playing on the computer speakers, and then the door swings open and I jump a fucking mile, turning the pages from the police files over quickly and covering them, as casually as possible, with my backpack. It's Janie. She bursts into my room, jumping onto the bed.
"Miles!" she shouts. "That movie was so good!"
I stand up and sit down, and knock my bag and the papers back more so they fall off the other side of the bed and onto the ground. "What movie was it?" I ask, hugging her to me. She smells like clean laundry and maple syrup.
"Moonrise Kingdom,"
she tells me.
"I wanted to see that.
Was it great?"
"So, so great. Where were you anyway?"
"Nowhere," I answer. "Just walking around."
"We tried calling you."
"Oh yeah? I guess my phone was off." I pause for a moment. Think. Stare at the floor. "Jane?" I say distractedly. "I know things have been hard around here. But I just... it's gonna get better. I promise. I'm going to fix everything." Her eyes open wide at me.
"But everything is okay, isn't it?"
"Sure, yeah, of course. But... you know what I mean." She shakes her head.
"Don't worry about that."
"No, you don't worry. That's what I'm saying. I am so close now to finding Teddy. This endless hell, this endless waiting is almost over. I just wish I could tell her. I wish I could tell somebody. But they will know it soon enough. When I bring our brother home..." I kiss Jane on the forehead, and we go out together to eat the hamburgers they brought back from Bill's place on Clement. The rain is falling outside, and I can hear it like static, loud across the rooftops. Water drops beat in sweat from the cracked ceiling overhead. But tonight we eat, and we are happy. Teddy is coming home. 23. By late morning, the rain has stopped. The school has rented out a bus for us to take down to the beach. It's part of a community service project where each class has to go work somewhere in the city every month. Going to pick up trash at the beach is definitely one of the easier jobs. And thankfully, Eliza's in tomorrow's group, so I don't have to worry about seeing her today. Preston, too, is in tomorrow's group. But I do get Jackie with me. We're sitting together on the bus, playing Words with Friends back and forth on her iPhone. The sky is silvery gray, as the sun breaks through the low-lying clouds in places. Jackie has a hat pulled back on her head, and a big parka zipped all the way up to just under her chin. It's seriously cold, and the heat in the bus is broken, so we can see our breath when we talk. I have on a long-sleeve undershirt, a hooded sweatshirt, and my army jacket, but I'm still fucking freezing. The bus rattles and shakes as it snakes down the winding cliff road to Ocean Beach. I've actually been avoiding coming here ever since Teddy was taken, just because it's been too painful, I guess. The day has replayed in my brain so many times, I didn't want to be forced to think about it any more than I already do. Besides, there are plenty of other beaches to go to north of the city and on the bay. But now, as we drive along the concrete breaker wall covered in graffiti, the ocean raging loud so we can hear it over the rumbling of the bus's straining engine, I can't help trying to pick out exactly which bathroom I locked myself in, and where it was that I last saw my brother. Somewhere out on the very edge of the shoreline. Through the scratched hard plastic bus windows, spattered with mud and smeared with rain not yet dried, the rocky sand and windswept dunes look like images from some post-apocalyptic dreamscape. The ocean seems to be moving in every direction at once, waves washing back out to sea from the sloping shoreline, so they slam against the incoming breakers and spray up 100 feet high. The bus turns into the deserted parking lot past the entrance to the beach on Noriega, and then I become aware that Jackie has been talking to me for some time now, though I haven't heard one thing.
What? I ask, turning back toward her. She bites down on her